Good morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I'm Nevena Smith. I was originally slated to do this. I got sick. I thought I was going to die, so I begged off, but I didn't die, so here I am. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, or family structure. We welcome you no matter what your age or your abilities or inabilities. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services. They are presented either by a Prairie member, a member of the wider community, or by our minister, Reverend Sandra Ingham. All right, Eileen Nettleton will read our opening words.
Whether we and our politicians know it or not, nature is party to all our deals and decisions, and she has more votes, a longer memory, and a sterner sense of justice than we do. Wendell Berry.
Dean and Orrin Schroeder are going to do this morning's chalice lighting.
This comes from South Africa, where they have mountains and they have oceans, so you might want to close your eyes and imagine that you're there. As we gather in the shadow of our mountain, the ocean laps around our feet. We reach deep for the silence within. Feel the rhythm of the ancient drum. We light our flame. It lifts us high. Our rainbow seems alight. Diverse as we are, together as one, our flame will shine afar and guide our journey's light.
Our speaker today is Tracy Hames. Tracy was raised in Arden Hills, Minnesota. He developed a love and appreciation for nature and the environment at a young age through many years hunting, fishing, and camping. Tracy obtained a BA from McAllister College in 1984 and an MS in Natural Resources from the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point in 1990. In 1989, he moved west to work for the Yakima Indian Nation, where he stayed for 22 years. At Yakima, he built one of the largest wetland protection and restoration projects in the Pacific Northwest. This project combined the knowledge and traditions of the Yakima people with science-based techniques to produce a cultural approach to restoration. A Midwesterner at heart, Tracy moved back to Wisconsin in 2011 to take the position of executive director with the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. WWA is a statewide nonprofit organization dedicated to the protection, restoration, and enjoyment of Wisconsin's wetlands. Tracy and staff have spent much time assessing the wetlands of the proposed mine project area in the Bad River watershed of the Pinoki Hills. Tracy?
Well, thank you so much for inviting me to come out here and talk about some of the passions in my world view and express the joy I have in wetlands and the people that care about wetlands. Like you said, my name is Tracy Hames, Executive Director with the Wisconsin Wetlands Association, and we're going to talk a little bit about some of the wetland resources. I'm going to get feedback. We'll talk about some of the wetland resources and the folks up in the northern part of the state, the Pinoki Hills. I wanted to start a little bit talking briefly about my background, give context of what gives you an idea of my feelings and how this work really, what it means to me. Next slide. As she said, I've been out in the arid west for the last 22 years on the Yakima Indian Reservation, which is in south central Washington state. City of Seattle is right here, Cascade Mountains. This is the reservation, 1.6 million acre reservation. And I was involved in working for the tribe there, about 10,000 members in that tribe. Okay. I was employed by the Yakima Nation's Wildlife Resource Management Program, one of the largest tribal resource programs in the nation. So this was just our wildlife folks. You can't see it. Unfortunately, there's clouds, but this is a big old volcano right here. That's Mount Adams. That's the western boundary of the reservation. It goes from tip of Mount Adams all the way east to the Yakima River. So next. I was the waterfowl biologist. I was in charge of the ducks. And we did a lot of work restoring wetlands and waterfowl habitat. And it was interesting because here I am, a Midwestern boy, waterfowl biologist by training, and I took a job working for a large tribe that didn't care much about ducks at all. They were salmon tribes, salmon, deer, and elk. So it was really neat because getting out and really helping the tribe reconnect with the waterfowl resources was a big part. I was the crazy duck guy over there. So it was my job to keep waterfowl on the minds of the Yakima people. And we did. We got a lot of involvement with the Yakima people back into wetlands and waterfowl and a lot of the community around. Everybody we could get working with waterfowl, we had them out there. So it was really fun getting out, reaching into many communities besides just the tribal communities. Okay. And the real approach that we took was not so much what can I do in my position to make things better for ducks or other resources, but really what can we do for the Yakima people? So the whole emphasis of the work we were doing, restoring habitats, bringing back some of these wetlands, was all about the people. Okay. Incredible, here's people that have been, on this landscape since the Ice Age or before even, and tied in very closely with the land and its people. Here's some tribal members harvesting tules, which is harvest and bulrush. They make mats out of this. And this is in a wetland that we restored that had been drained and converted to agriculture for 75 years. So restored the hydrology in here, and all these plants came up out of the ground. We never did any wetland planting. Okay, next. Some of the real exciting things, because what's happened out in the arid west is these watersheds have been turned upside down with irrigation, the development of irrigated agriculture, and a lot of these wetlands have been gone for over 100 years. So when we started restoring some of these areas, this is that same formerly ag field, plants started coming up that had been gone from the reservation for over 100 years. And it was so exciting. This is Emily Washeen. She did her master's thesis work studying this plant, what they call Wapato, which we call Arrowhead. It had been gone. I only knew a couple of places on the res where we had this plant in small quantities. When we started restoring these wetlands, it came up out of the ground. Where it came from, we don't know. Anyways, it was so exciting. The tribe was reconnecting, learning about this plant again, learning how to grow it, learning how to harvest it, learning how to utilize it, and then getting it back into the longhouses in their traditions and ceremonies next. Here's Virginia. She was 84 years old. The last time she'd eaten Wapato was she was 12. So this is the stuff that really gets me excited. I work, I love ducks, I love wetlands, but bringing it together and working with the people and helping restore people's culture and enhance that is what I'm all about. So I had to give that little background to lead into where we're going now, and now that I'm back in Wisconsin. Next. So we're the Wisconsin Wetlands Association, and she talked about our mission: protection, restoration, and enjoyment of wetlands. The enjoyment is an important one. It brings the human part of it in. And that was really important when I came back to take this job, was that it wasn't just something that we're dealing, blindly or facelessly restoring wetlands. There was a human component to it, and that's what I'm really interested in. I mean, I love these wetlands; they're my passion. I live to be out in these things. So we're science-based, nonpartisan membership organization. Next. Okay, what are we doing up in the Pinoki Hills? So, a little over a year ago, the tribal members from the leaders from the Voight Commission asked me to come up and give a presentation. And that was just before, when the first mining bill had failed, but the second mining bill that ultimately passed was right up, looming on the horizon. And in our discussions, obviously the talk came to the mind, and they asked me, will Wisconsin Wetlands get involved in this? And I made a promise to the tribal leaders at that time that we would. And by the way, of course, working for a tribe for 22 years, when I came back here, it was really important for me to reach out to the tribe. So I really enjoyed getting to know the 11 tribes in Wisconsin. So made a promise. We said, all right, let's get up there. We're going to be a part of this, not knowing what I was getting into. Okay, next. So here's where it is, in case, you know, a lot of people have heard about the mine, but where is it? It's way up almost to Ashland in the Pinoki Hills, which is a ridge in the Bad River watershed. Next slide. Here's a map of the Bad River watershed. The iron body is right here. This is the Bad River Reservation right here. Ashland is right here. And this area is the Kakagan Bad River Sloughs, which we'll talk about in a minute. And this is where the actual mine site is located. It's in the top of the Bad River watershed. The water flows through this ridge in a couple locations. It goes south first, and then it heads north, south, and then it heads north, and all ultimately ends up in what we call the Kakagan Bad River Sloughs, the largest freshwater estuary on Lake Superior. So I'm one of those people that I can't sit in an office in Madison and deal with an issue. I can't. I have to experience, I have to be out on the landscape, be incredibly familiar with what I'm talking about if I'm going to speak about a resource. So that's 300 miles away from Madison. Unfortunately, we're way in the south end of the state. So we went out and hit the hills. We headed for the hills this spring. Okay, next. And got put our boots on and decided if we're gonna work on this, we gotta know what's up there. Okay, next. So we put our plans together and used the maps of what we knew about where the project was being located, where were they gonna dig the pit, where were they gonna put all the waste rock. And I didn't include this in the talk because that's too much detail for a short presentation. So we got up and got on the landscape, okay? And of course, we're wetlands, so we were looking at the wetland resources of the upper watershed. And I will tell you, when we got up there, when I made the promise to work on this issue, and then we went up there the first time, I was thinking, oh boy, what are we getting into? And I did not expect to find what we found up there. A lot of the watersheds in that part of the state have been heavily degraded by clear cutting over 100 years ago. A lot of them haven't recovered. This isn't one of them. This is a watershed, an upper watershed area that is unbelievably intact. I never expected to see the quality of the habitats and how well this place is functioning. Flabbergasted. So we'll talk a little bit, show some pictures of what's up there. Okay, next. You've got an incredibly abundant wetland landscape in the upper watershed of the Bad River. It's at about 1,900 foot elevation. There's a high amount of precipitation and snowpack in there. And the landscape has evolved with a lot of wetlands to handle that quantity of water that lands on the ground. These are ephemeral wetlands. These are incredibly abundant out there. They catch a lot of the snowmelt and the rainfall and hold it up and process that water. They're usually dry by the end of the summer, but surprisingly, a lot of the wetlands up there that we call ephemeral are actually wet all summer long and into the fall. So I was really surprised at the amount of water in that area. Next. A lot of really neat forest, swamp, black ash and cedar swamps with this beautiful carpet of sphagnum moss. The green in there is all sphagnum moss. Just, you walk through that and it's just squishy, it's really neat. And you lift up the sphagnum, even in the heat of the summer, and there's standing water underneath these things. I didn't show it, but there's some unbelievably large cedar trees in here in places that have been relatively untouched for quite a long time. Beautiful, beautiful forests, okay? Spruce bogs, abundant spruce bogs in these areas, accepting a lot of the runoff and a lot of groundwater. In the area, very complicated groundwater interactions in a place like this that nobody understands yet. Okay, and wet meadows. Oh my gosh, gorgeous wet meadows, hundreds of acres. This one here is about a 200-acre meadow that every time I went out there, different plants were in flower. Oh, and this was, I think, in late August, early September. Just gorgeous, and. It was a joke around the office because every time I'd come back, I was up there probably 15 times over the course of the spring and summer, you know, making the trip. and getting out in these wetlands. And every time I come back, I have my favorite wetland. Oh, I just found my new favorite wetland. This is one of them. Next. So let's talk a little bit about why the wetlands are important up there. Sure, the wetlands are important for what they are. The wet meadow is important because it's a wet meadow, because it's a good quality wet meadow. But what else, what of other importance are these wetlands to the region? And that's going to be a big part of, as we're dealing with this mine issue, not the so what, so it's a wetland, big deal, aren't there wetlands everywhere? What are these wetlands doing for the rest of the watershed? Like I said, these hills get between 60 to 200 inches of snow a year and a lot of precipitation. 1,900 foot elevation up there, and the watershed drops down to 600 feet at Lake Superior. So, a lot of snow lands on this ground here. And the healthy forests and the wetlands then take that snow and allow it to slowly, really slowly melt. If you didn't have shaded areas, you would have much quicker snow melt in the spring than you do now. This picture was taken actually May 24th. There was 2 foot of snow right there. Okay, next. So the wetlands, the abundant wetlands on the landscape then capture this snow melt. In the spring, this wetland, this is another sedge meadow with a channel running through the middle of it. That's all going to be standing water out there. In the background is the top of the ridge where the pit's going to be. So this is really right on the toe of the hill, ground zero just about. And so the abundant wetlands then take that snow melt. The trees slow down the melt. The wetlands capture the snow melt. Next. And then they allow the up there they call it slowing the flow. They allow that snow melt and the runoff to be captured by the wetlands. It soaks into the ground and really charges the shallow groundwater areas. And that water then slowly works its way down towards the creeks and rivers downstream in the watershed. Incredibly important when we're talking about the creek and river health in this area. The rule is, if you put cold water into the ground, cold water comes out of the ground later. Okay, so in the spring you get snow melt, cold water soaking into the ground in these wetlands. That migrates through the ground and comes out later in the summer in some of these trout streams, keeping that water cool during the hot time of the year. Really important concept. And this is what it looks like. This is Tyler Forks River, which is a tributary to the Bad River, which is one of the highest quality tributaries in the Bad River watershed. Abundant trout, cool, clear waters, and this is going to be potentially one of the most affected waterways of the area. People look at this and say, well, wait a minute, that looks like brown water. Why is that water brown? Actually, that color shows that this is a healthy area, that there are healthy wetlands in this watershed. Those are from tannins. Those are the tannic acid from the bogs turn the water a copper color, and it comes down that way. So yeah, that's actually, if you see that color, you know there's good wetlands in the system. So very important how wetlands then help not just regulate the cool of the water, but they also regulate the hydrograph. If we didn't have these wetlands capturing the water, all that snow melt would run off in the spring. It would go down into the lake. You'd use up all your water by the summer. Places like this would be much drier. So the summer base flow in a place like this, cool, clear water, is dependent upon the wetlands in the upper watershed. Okay. Wetlands also reduce flooding. They capture the water, like we said. That's pretty easy to understand. Next. Incredibly diverse plant and animal life. We've got a situation up here. The upper watershed of the Bad River is one of the most intact watersheds, I'm not kidding, that I've seen anywhere in the country. I didn't expect it. Unbelievably diverse, and what surprised me the most was the level of naturalness. It's mostly native plant communities in these wetlands. You see very few invasive species up there. You'll see a few new canary grass plants and a few other things, but they're not getting a hold, they're not able to come in, and the reason is because of the hydrology and landscape in this area is intact and it's functioning correctly. The native plant communities are able to outcompete any invasive canary grass or other plants that are trying to move into the area. And all those plants are up in that part of the state. It's not that they're not there, it's that these wetlands are in such good condition, they keep the bad stuff out. And not too many places around the state will find those types of conditions. So,
is that
yeah.
a snake?
No, that's a salamander.
Another one above.
Oh, that's a frog in a little, yeah, that's a frog in a little knothole on a down log.
Oh, yeah.
He's facing this way, yeah. And that's the other one's a burry. That's one of my favorite ones. So, yeah. Oh, and it's that was, you know, another one of the big joyful surprises I had getting out on this landscape this year as well, is discovering the lack of invasiveness. Okay, next. Wetlands enhanced trout habitat. This was my daily, weekly favorite wetland at the time. This is a big wet meadow with Bulgas Creek running through the middle. So I was walking out in this, I had my hip boots on. It's about 2 foot of water where the grasses are. And I thought, you know, this is actually where the open water, that's the channel of the creek. I thought, well, I'm going to stand in the creek and get a nice picture of that. So I took one step out and went right up over my waist. And what you have is an absolutely classically formed wetland floodplain creek channel that doesn't get any better than this. Deep and narrow, providing really good, cool, clear, deep water for trout. If this type of situation was out in the Pacific Northwest, people would be coming for miles around to see what great salmon habitat we had in a place like this. So common up in this area. Wetlands also reduce sediment. This is not the Bad River watershed, but it's near Bayfield. This is two river courses that flow into Lake Superior near Bayfield. These pictures were taken 45 minutes apart, about a mile and a half apart. The one on the left has an intact upper watershed, healthy wetlands. The one on the right does not. That's the difference. That's the difference that these upper watershed wetland systems make in your rivers like that. So
taking topsoil.
Mm-hmm. Taking topsoil, yes. What happens when you take your water off all at once and you don't store it in your wetlands, it comes down. It's all about gravity and energy. That water comes down all at once. The channels up there don't have the capacity to take that quantity of water, and they dig out all that erosion, then heads downstream and dumps into the bottom of the watershed. I've spent my career working in these types of situations. I know what it's like. The other real neat, surprising thing was the amount of how important beavers are up in these watersheds. Unbelievable amounts of beaver activity here. Once again, this is right at the toe of the hill. This area is where the pit is, and this is at the very top end of Bulgas Creek. 7 foot beaver dam holding this together. Next. This is a 10 foot tall beaver dam. A couple of our staff, Aaron O'Brien and Kyle Maguera, out there. Behind that hill behind them is a beaver dam, ancient beaver dam. It's holding a wetland more than 50 acres just behind this one wetland. And they're not even standing at the bottom of it yet. Unbelievable. Beavers have come in and created wetland conditions, and they move around with the landscape. There's beaver dams 2 inches tall, all the way up to 10 foot tall in this area. And they're capturing that slow flow, stopping it, allowing the sediments that are in the runoff to collect, and helping keep that water cool and clean all the way down the hill. So, next. Jumping down to the bottom, where does this water all end up? So as we said, this water goes north and it ends up ultimately into Lake Superior. At the bottom end of it, there's the largest estuary on Lake Superior called the Kakagan Bad River Sloughs Estuary. Water flows downhill. Everything that comes from the mine site has to go through this incredibly large, complex wetland area. Next. This is on the Bad River Reservation. It has abundant wild rice resources. This is the cultural lifeblood of the Bad River people right now. This is, not only is the wild rice here, but there's fish spawning and sturgeon in this area. There's piping plovers and all kinds of things in this unbelievably complicated estuary situation here. Next, it has been declared a wetland of international importance. We helped put together the application for that. There's only 30 in the United States with that kind of designation, and we had the honor of presenting it in the inset as Mike Wiggins, chairman of the Bad River Tribe. We were able to present them the designation award, and we've also called it a wetland gem. It is an incredibly important, globally important wetland. And all the water comes down to it, and where this is really being threatened, and that's what we're looking at, is if you mess up the water near the watershed and it comes down into this wetland, remember, this is where it flattens out into Lake Superior. All the sediment's going to drop out at this location. This place is going to start filling up. And they're already having some impacts with lower Lake Superior levels in this estuary. There's other plants moving into the wild rice beds right now because the drop in the water levels. So you put sedimentation on top of that, we're really worried about that. That could be a double whammy that may really, really impact the rice beds. Next. So when it comes down to it though, and I don't have as many pictures because when I go up there, I'm always taking pictures of the wetlands and things, but it's really been the people that we've been working with here that's been so meaningful to me, getting out, getting to know the local folks. This is at the Harvest Camp. Maybe you've heard about the Couderay Tribe putting a harvest education camp up in the hills to help teach people about what's going on in the tribal cultures and that. Next. This is Mel. He runs the camp. He's been just wonderful teaching people about the ways. Next. They're building birch bark canoes there that you can learn about. On the right is a cattail mat. We showed you earlier the tule harvest, the bulrush harvest by the tribal members. That's what they look like. They make mats. They tie them all together. And this one happens to be made out of cattail. But wetland plants are used for a lot of structural things with Indian people. So we get to see that. Next. I'm getting to know the local people, some of the people involved in this. I mean, it's so fun to go into these areas. These are people that this is their homeland being threatened, and they're getting out and working together to help address this issue. And it's been so nice working with these people. It's friends for life. Bringing people up from other parts of the state into the area has been wonderful. Getting people out to see this. Next. Getting other wetland landowners up in these hills. There's once again the toe of the slope right there, and that's a big wetland that they're standing in, and getting them excited about these resources. Next. And family members. This is my nephew, and getting him out and teaching him about this area as well has been so rewarding. So it's all about the resource, it's about the people, and it's about all these things combined. And that's what's been really given me hope about this whole situation. We really feel that this mine is never going to come in for a lot of different reasons, and one of them is the absolute high quality of the resource up there and the devastation of removing these upper watershed wetlands, how that will have implications all the way down the line. So we're happy, we're optimistic, but it's going to be many years of work ahead of us. This isn't going to go away overnight. So next. What can you do? Spread the word, educate yourself. Support those that are doing. There's a lot of folks working on this issue. We're covering the wetlands and hydrology, and that's it. There's other people working on the grunerite and the sulfur and everything else. We're doing what we're experts in, so that's get involved, okay? That's it. Thank you very much. And I'll be around afterwards if people have questions or want to talk more. This is the Nickel Tour of the Pinocchio Wetlands, so thanks for your attention.
Any questions? You know, it's interesting that's one of many issues now that are arising out of this. I mean, that's one reason we're optimistic, is that there's every way you look at an angle of what's going on up here, what's being proposed, there are roadblocks to the development of this mine, and the grunerite's one of them. They knew that there was the potential of this rock up there, and it's very early on right now. They found a few instances where the rocks are actually there. More study needs to be done about how much it is out there, so there definitely has to be more concern, but it's an incredibly important concern what happens when that gets into the air, etc., etc. I think there are federal laws that we can use to address the air quality issues right now. The state, a lot of our angles, because of the new mining law, unfortunately, a lot of the state's ability to regulate some of the activities up here has been hampered a little bit. So we're looking, a lot of the work we're doing is emphasizing the federal regulatory processes and the tribal treaty rights. Ultimately, this whole thing may end up as a tribal lawsuit, and making sure that we are laying the groundwork for those activities. So you're going to find you're going to find a lot of holes, especially in the state regulatory end of it, but we're going on that assumption that that's going to be the case. So one thing I didn't do, and in my longer presentation, I give this presentation around the state, and I talk a little bit more specifically about what's being proposed. And what they're talking about is a 4.5 mile long pit that's about a mile wide, and it has to be a big pit because the iron formation is at a 60 degree angle. It's not flat. So you have to dig this huge pit to get at this goofy, you know, fold in the iron. And so that means a lot of rock, a lot of waste rock, and a lot of tailings because it's low-grade taconite. So there's two things. There's the waste rock and the tailings. And right now it's so early on, and this company has been so vague on what they're proposing. They've got a site where they're going to dig up this hole and get the iron out, and they're going to dump all this waste rock mostly in the area that we've been studying. That's actually, from our perspective, from a wetland standpoint, the biggest impact isn't digging the hole. It's where they're putting all the rock that they're taking out of the hole. And we've estimated that it's over 1,000 acre land area. And when you calculate the amount of rock that's going to come out of that hole, that'll be about a 600 foot tall pile of rock. So all the wetlands that you saw in these pictures will be under 600 feet of rock. So our angle is, okay, removing that amount of rock, how is that going to affect how the water works through the rest of the watershed? So that's a whole nother talk, getting into tribal treaty rights and resources. Yeah. But you know, this is where the bad people live. They've lived here for hundreds of years, and they have resources that are fundamental to their livelihood, to their life, to their culture. And the wild rice is it. There's deer and other wetland resources. And this is stuff I've been working with my whole career. When you're dealing with projects like this that may have tribal implications, it's really important to document how the tribe is using these resources, why it's important to their culture, the wild rice, that's real easy. And then being able to scientifically connect the dots between what they're proposing here and how is that going to affect the treaty reserved resources that the tribe has now in a treaty with the federal government. And then getting the federal government to honor that treaty. Treaties are the highest law of the land. And when you make that connection, you have a strong treaty, and you can point, if you do this, then this will happen, incredibly powerful in a court of law. So I'm hoping that plays out here as well. So we're very carefully now, as a science-based organization then, working with the tribe to make sure we can, if it comes to a court of law, we can say, if you do this, here's why this is going to happen. And cross the T's and dot the I's. So that's the big unknown. That's another reason why we're fairly optimistic on this issue. If this was really high-grade stuff and it was a real profitable operation, I'd be a lot more nervous than I am right now. This is, as far as everybody can tell, this is an economically marginal deal. So a lot of people, a lot of geologists are saying, we don't even know why they're bothering with this. It's been so many years, no one's looked at this because of that. There's a lot of theories now on what's really going on. So, and I don't want to get into that. I'm not going to spout. I have my theories and everybody else does, and some of them make more sense than others, but we're scratching our heads on what are they doing here. Well, and that's something that is so important to discuss amongst yourselves. Yeah. I'm not going to get into the philosophy of resource use. I mean, that's something you all have to look at. It's fundamental to what we're doing. Do we want do we want iron in our society? Do we want to use iron? If so, we got to get it from somewhere. You know, we've pulled a lot of it out. We can recycle a lot of it now. So, I mean, all these are such fundamental. We've got to make sure that this is not a NIMBY situation. That, and I think we can make this point, that if there are appropriate places for a mine, whether you agree there are or not, this certainly isn't one of them. Yeah. And that's a big part of our, it doesn't help us to be coming out saying we're against mines altogether. We have to bring the science in and say, if you think you want to put a mine here, let's do the science and see if it's a good idea or not. And pretty early on, it's coming out that it's probably a pretty bad idea. This situation is coming at a perfect time. The Environmental Protection Agency has just released a draft report about how wetlands connect to the flow of watersheds and influence how watersheds work, how the water works through a watershed. It's a 350-page scientific document. It's still in draft form. They haven't officially approved it. But when you read that thing, it's a textbook of how this kind of stuff and hundreds of studies are connected and how the effects of losing your upper watersheds have implications down the line. So yeah, incredible science, watershed science behind the concepts that we're talking about here. And a lot of good examples of that and a lot of good examples of where it's been lost and the implications. I've spent my career restoring lower watershed wetlands and floodplain systems in situations a lot like this, mountain kind of based precipitation, much bigger systems than this, of course, but the things we had to do to try and bring back the wetlands because of what went on in those upper watersheds, you know, it was impossible to restore some of these things. So yeah, what you do in one place affects other portions of the watershed pretty significantly. So you know, I'd left the state for 22 years and came back, and I've spent the last 2 years really getting myself reacquainted with Wisconsin. Every weekend, my wife knows, she's back there, I'm out driving around somewhere, not just the Pinoki Hills, getting re-familiar with the wetlands out here, and I've been to Horicon again. And you know, a couple of things. We've lost about half of the historic wetlands in the state of Wisconsin in the last 150 years, and a lot of it's been in the central and southern part of the state. A lot of it due to agricultural development. And a lot of the wetlands that are left are in pretty degraded state right now. When I first came out here, driving around, looking at the resources, at first it was really disheartening. I got really depressed thinking, my gosh, have we got a challenge here? This is really, there's a lot of bad things in this state from a wetland standpoint. But then I started meeting the people. And started looking at what's going on, who's involved, and this is all over the state. There are groups and there's organizations now getting to know the resources, working to protect and restore the quality of the wetland resources in their areas. And Horicon's a good example of that. There's a lot of folks working together to keep that place healthy. By the way, that's another one of the internationally recognized wetlands in Wisconsin. There's three of them: Horicon, the Kakagan Sloughs, and the Upper Mississippi River wetlands. So people are starting to recognize the resources and the importance of this. And what we're trying to do now is really, we're working with private individuals and local governments to get them to understand the importance of wetlands for other reasons. Well, because of the flooding, because it's cleaning your water, and using, getting people to think about a watershed perspective and how wetlands play a part in not just the ecological health, but the economic health, and everything else about your region. So that's, I've turned around from being depressed to being really excited about the possibilities now in Wisconsin. And the Pinokies is one that we got heavily involved in, but it's taken a lot of our time, but we're involved throughout the rest of the state as well. And this is the tragic thing about situations like this, is it really tears communities apart. And the problem is people take positions that are not informed by facts. So a big part of what we're trying to do is lay the facts down and say, you know, I don't care if you're for or against the mine. Well, maybe I care, but understand the implications. Okay, you might, then maybe this is acceptable to you that we destroy this watershed and the sloughs and all these resources, but don't be pro-mine without understanding the implications of what this will do. And you know, that's a big part of our messaging. I think a lot of people, when they see this, then they'll understand, well, maybe there are other ways to use these lands. So I'll be around afterwards to talk more, and there's some materials on the back table as well that you can pick up if you'd like, and yeah, we can talk some more. But it's going to be around for a long time, so you know, thank you guys for getting interested in this at such an early stage, and we'll see where it takes us.
Thank you, Tracy. That was really excellent. Lynn Pawlski will read our closing words.
From Wendell Berry, from the Long-Legged House. We have lived our lives by the assumption that what was good for us would be good for the world. We have been wrong. We must change our lives so that it will be possible to live by the contrary assumption, that what is good for the world will be good for us. And that requires that we make the effort to know the world and learn what is good for it.
We extinguish this flame, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment. These we carry in our hearts until we are together again. All right, and thank you for coming. Please extend the hand of friendship to those around you, and then join us for coffee and conversation.